Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll look into a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the disgusting moral vacuum at the very top of leadership in America today, with the president who could not disavow ugly racist comments by Roseanne, but rather complained that the head of Disney who fired her apologized to Valerie Jarrett, but not to the injured, frail ego of Donald Trump, who has been hurt by the horrible statements on ABC that were said about him. Dr. Andrew Hartman, a professor of history at Illinois State University, whose latest book is A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars, joins us to discuss his article at The Baffler, The Culture Wars Are Dead, Long Live the Culture Wars. We will explore this return to Trump's Charlottesville moment, where he panders to the worst manifestations of our racist past, which he, Trump, helped resurrect with the Birther Movement. A movement Trump began, which in effect gave permission to American racists to come out of the shadows and openly express their racist and conspiratorial views, turning back the clock on the nation's long and painful struggle to discover the better angels of our nature. Then we will speak with Mark Galeotti, a senior researcher at the Institute for International Relations in Prague, who is an expert on transnational crime and Russian security affairs, and whose latest book is The Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. He joins us to discuss the history of organized crime from Tsarist times through the Soviet Union to Russia today, which is a kleptocracy in which the ruling oligarchs and the ex-intelligence Siloviki work hand-in-hand with the Vori, the criminal gangs, who in turn work with the security services and the government. We will also explore Trump's links to organized crime, given his open-door policy to Russian criminals with money to launder. Then finally, we'll get an analysis of the political upheaval in Italy, which has spooked the markets, and speak with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University, who writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, and propaganda. She joins us to discuss the alarming possibility that the current political crisis in Italy has been engineered by the slick right-wing leader of the League, Matteo Salvini, who could win the next election and is threatening to, quote, march on Rome, which has unmistakable echoes of Mussolini's rise. And joining us now, Dr. Andrew Hartman is a professor of history at Illinois State University, who was the founding president of the Society for U.S. Intellectual History. His latest book is A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars. And he has an article at The Baffler, The Culture Wars Are Dead, Long Live the Culture Wars. Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. Andrew Hartman.
Thank you very much. I'm happy to be here.
Well, thank you, Andrew. And we seem to be in the midst of the culture wars in terms of Roseanne, a popular TV show on ABC. She tweeted out the most horrible racist remarks along with ridiculous conspiratorial nonsense about George Soros. And there's been a certain expectation on the part of the media waiting to see what President Trump will say, because he, of course, promoted her show and congratulated her because her character in Roseanne is a Trumpster. She's openly supportive of Trump. But it turned out finally that Trump did respond, but he responded in a tweet to the CEO of Disney, Bob Iger, where he said absolutely nothing about Roseanne Barr's racist and conspiratorial tweets, but instead complained that Bob Iger of ABC called Valerie Jarrett to let her know that ABC does not tolerate comments like these made by Roseanne Barr. But she never called Donald Trump to apologize for the horrible statements made and said about me on ABC. Maybe I just didn't get the call. So there you have a combination of the sort of the childish injury that Trump displays all the time on top of a complete disregard for what Roseanne Barr said. So it's just not surprising, but incredibly depressing.
Not surprising at all, and that one tweet really does summarize for us what Trump seems to represent in the current moment, or who he is as a president, as a politician, in addition to just being playing the victim card, the fake victim card, and being a narcissist. It's all about him. He is ignoring the fact that Roseanne's tweets were incredibly racist, and they're of a moment. that he has given life to, and that is that it seems as if Trump has pulled the scab off the wounds that have yet to heal fully from, you know, slavery, from Jim Crow. The civil rights movement sought to heal these wounds, and it seems like they have yet to heal, and Trump's whole MO has been to just poke at these wounds and pull the scab off these wounds.
But not only is he not addressing Roseanne Barr's racism, in many ways it seems like he has encouraged racism or even revived it to some extent, because he was the person who started this birther conspiracy during Obama's presidency. And that, to my mind, was a way to give Trump's followers, or to awaken, if you will, the sleeping giant, where we had, you know, a number of decades where people understood that racism was something of the past, or tried to make it something of the past, and it was certainly nothing to celebrate and so nothing to express openly. But Trump comes along and gives people permission to be racists. I mean, frankly, I can't put it any other way.
No, I think that's exactly right. And Trump in this way represents a shift, because the civil rights movement did not succeed in overcoming racial inequality by any close measure. It had a lot of successes, but racial inequality persisted. But in sort of polite discussions, people quit being racist for the most part. Even a staunch conservative from the South, who in the 1950s would have been openly racist in their interpretation of political matters, by the 1980s, someone like that was likely to quote, or misquote perhaps, but quote Martin Luther King, or take Martin Luther King's, you know, content of character quotes out of context. And that would be the sort of colorblind logic behind their notion that we no longer needed to talk about race. So it was a sort of coded discussion. And if Republican politicians tried to race bait or tried to use the race card, they had to do it in coded ways. So this was Nixon talking about law and order, or the George H.W. Bush campaign using the pretty racist Willie Horton advertising campaign. They couldn't just come out and be racist. And Trump seems to have enabled people to come, people like Roseanne, people like the Charlottesville Nazis, to come out and be racist again. He's empowered people like this.
So do you think, though, that the birther campaign that he ginned up about Trump's birth certificate and him being a Kenyan interloper without a birth certificate to delegitimize the president of the United States, and also there's an unmistakable racist tinge to that, is it possible that Trump was actually building a constituency which later has paid off for him?
Yes, I think that's entirely the case. I think, you know, he's very good in this way about sort of sticking his finger out in the wind and seeing which way the wind is blowing. And the birther campaign might have been his first effort at such. And it caught wind, and there was a sizable enough chunk of the American population that got behind the birther campaign that I think he was onto something there. And so he's failed in many ways, but he's been highly successful at stoking the racial divisions in our society. And in this way, has become sort of the chief culture warrior. And he always knows that the key to his political success is to get his base, which is maybe 25% of the American population, get it angry and sort of behind him. And the way to do that is to stoke these fires. And so he's going to go out of his way not to offend this base. And if he had been critical of Roseanne's comments, I think he would have offended this base. In the same way that last summer with the Charlottesville Nazi March, which ended in the death of one individual at the hands of a Nazi, he said something like, most of these people are very fine people. He's going to really go out of his way not to offend this core base that thinks that they're the victims in the sort of racial battles in American life.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Andrew Hartman, a professor of history at Illinois State University, who was the founding president of the Society for U.S. Intellectual History. His latest book is A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars. And he has an article at The Baffler, The Culture Wars Are Dead, Long Live the Culture Wars. But on top of Trump's racism, or together with it, of course, you have these conspiracy theories that he's ginning up. I mean, he's ginning up this whole idea of Spygate. And he had a rally in Nashville on Tuesday where he just went off the deep end with Spygate and was talking about something that didn't happen. He was actually contradicted, by the way, by a very conservative congressman, Trey Gowdy, who was responsible for the Benghazi witch hunt. He was able to go in on these meetings that Devin Nunes had forced through the White House, had managed to cook up, looking for evidence in this so-called ginned-up Spygate conspiracy. But Trey Gowdy has disavowed Nunes and Trump and basically said there's no there. There was no evidence that the FBI infiltrated or spied on Trump's campaign. But that doesn't seem to matter, does it? This is the amazing part. I mean,
No. There seemed to be more than ever, or at least more than in a long time. There's a level of distrust that a core group of Americans, the core Trump supporters, have with mainstream institutions, media being chief amongst such institutions. And so if there's this, if there's evidence that there's no Spygate, that really doesn't matter if Trump continues to tout that as a story. And, he's ridden this to success so far. He's been able to avoid the controversies that mount up against him. He's been able to avoid any real consequences because of the way in which he counters with these conspiracies that his base believes. And so it's a really sort of weird and perhaps dangerous situation because people are so many people are so far removed from reality. And I mean, let's face it, there's always been a strong tendency amongst Americans to believe conspiracy theories. But the Republican Party, for a good chunk of the second half of the 20th century, had worked hard to some degree distance themselves from the more loony conspiracy theories that might have emerged from the John Birch Society. Mainstream conservatism, but of the William Buckley Jr. variety, to some degree tried to always distance themselves from such conspiracy theorizing. But Trump is the chief conspiracy theorist, and he recognizes, I think, that the ways in which our news, our information is channeled according to our political ideologies and according to our demographics, that what he says will fly with a core group of his constituency.
And, of course, this may well be where the Republican Party is at. I mean, when you contrast Trump and his moral vacuity, look at, in contrast, John McCain, who's dying at the moment, and Trump's staff members made callous remarks about him. Well, he's going to die soon, so who cares about him? But you recall during the campaign running against Obama for presidency in 2008, one of McCain's supporters said that Obama, he's an Arab. And McCain said, no, he's not. He's a good Christian man and he's a good man and we shouldn't say that kind of thing. That, I think when McCain dies, I think the soul of the Republican Party dies. It's history going back to Abraham Lincoln. I mean, so if you, without belaboring any kind of Nazi analogies, if Trump is our Führer, then is our Joseph Goebbels therefore Rupert Murdoch? Because none of this would be working unless you had the echo chamber that Fox and the right-wing media have created to maintain the drumbeat to spread Trump's lies about Spygate. A huge adjunct to Trump, is it not?
Yes, and for this, I think history is important. There's a great book by Nicole Hemmer called Messengers of the Right about the rise of right-wing media. And Rupert Murdoch, of course, was key, but he was not alone. There was a sort of concerted effort from the 1960s on by conservatives who had a lot of money to create an alternative media that would be more than, you know, that would sort of go beyond these notions of professionalism that the quote-unquote mainstream media has, and that would really sort of work as an arm of the Republican Party or an arm of the conservative movement, which the Republican Party eventually became one and the same as. And so Fox News and all of this is really key to this, and so they see themselves as partisans, and Trump is currently their leader.
So in terms of America's Kulturkampf, to use the German phrase of culture war, what's your sense of whether there'll be a pushback? I mean, it's worth reminding ourselves. You said there's only about 25% of the population are the hardcore supporters of Trump. It makes me wonder why the majority is silent. I mean, we talk about the silent majority. We have tyranny of the minority. What's wrong with the majority? Are they simply not being heard, or are they not making enough noise?
Well, I think it's a little of both. I think that there is a loud minority that's at least trying to make their voices heard. But one of the problems is that, you know, the ethos of professionalism in the media, I think, is a bit wrongheaded right now, because in the sort of mainstream television media, because as opposed to understanding their job as seeking truth, it seems to me for a long time the job has been to give both sides equal airtime and let viewers or listeners decide for themselves. And I think in the context of a party which is led by a man who's a pathological liar, and a large sort of landscape of media which sees it as its job to support him, the rest of the media it just kind of is paralyzed by this, because they see it, because they don't understand that, oh, our job is to discover the truth. And maybe I'm overstating the case a bit, but I think that that's one of the problems. I think a lot of Americans are just tired of the political conflict, and of course, perhaps don't recognize that the best way to overcome the current conflict is to defeat the right. And then I think one of the other problems is just the ways in which Democrats have been ineffective at creating a message that's going to appeal to a majority, but also because the Democrats have been hamstrung by gerrymandering and other sort of institutional mechanisms that have kept Republicans in the majority politically, even where they are in the minority in terms of the raw numbers.
Well, just to end on a positive note, or at least try and find some optimism here, the fact that ABC acted the way they did and Disney acted the way they did, that surely is encouraging. I know that your point is well taken. The media are conflicted because, after all, the mainstream media gave Donald Trump $5 billion worth of free advertising. That's how he got elected. So
yes,
they feel obliged to cover the crazy daily antics. And frankly, we have government by stunt. That's his whole MO. He doesn't have a clue about how to run a country or even run his own business. But for Russian mob money, he wouldn't have gotten anywhere. But he sure knows how to manipulate people and distract us all from his incredible inadequacy, not to mention his massive character flaws. So just in closing, is there any little optimistic boost you can give us?
Well, hopefully more and more people will pay attention to the hypocrisy of those who are coming to Roseanne's defense, and maybe this will sort of shine a light on the larger issues. So, for example, I would say Trump and many of those who are critical of ABC for silencing Roseanne, so to speak, critical of ABC for stomping on her free speech rights. These are the same people who are applauding the NFL for not allowing mostly black, but NFL players to kneel during the anthem in protest. It's all very divisive, and most people are very cynical about these things, but maybe more and more people start to notice the rank hypocrisy.
Well, Dr. Andrew Hartman, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you very much.
And again, I've been speaking with Dr. Andrew Hartman, who's a professor of history at Illinois State University, who was the founding president of the Society for U.S. Intellectual History. His latest book is A War for the Soul of America, A History of the Culture Wars. And he has an article at The Baffler, The Culture Wars Are Dead, Long Live the Culture Wars. We're going to take a brief station break. We're back talking with an expert on transnational crime and Russian security affairs about his new book, The Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. Ain't no sound but the sound of speed. Machine guns ready to go. Are you ready? Hey, are you ready for this? Are you hanging on the edge of your seat? Out of the doorway, the bullets rip to the sound of the beat, yeah. Another one bites the dust. Another one bites the dust. And another one gone, and another one gone. Another one bites the dust, hey. Hey, I'm gonna get you too.
What a crime! In the old time, in the old time, in the old time, it was not a crime! Not a crime! Not a crime!
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now from the UK is Mark Galeotti, who's a senior researcher at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, an expert on transnational crime and Russian security affairs. He has also advised the British Foreign Office and many government and law enforcement agencies in Europe and North America. And his latest book just out is The Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. Welcome to Background Briefing, Mark Galeotti.
Great to be here.
And one of the extraordinary phenomena about Russia today and dealing with Russia today is that you have this unprecedented geopolitical phenomenon of organized crime and national security. In other words, nuclear weapons and the mafia. And if that's not bad enough, you have Russia itself as a kleptocracy where there is obviously no rule of law and no respect for the law. And curiously enough, in the Soviet days, at least there was sort of an ideology and even a morality. But in the end of your book, you suggest that there may be, at the end of the day, a reversal of this kleptocracy. So let's start with the positive or the hopeful. What makes you think that the Russian people will eventually be able to rid themselves of Putin's criminal kleptocracy, the Siloviki, and in general, the rampant corruption in the country?
Well, obviously, it's going to take a long time. It's going to be a generational process. But Russian DNA isn't different from anyone else's. It's not forged in little handcuffs. And the interesting thing is, even while we're seeing that the Russian officialdom is full of thieves and kleptocrats, and Russian organized crime is a truly global phenomenon, at the same time, if you talk to ordinary Russians, it's clear that there is considerable dissatisfaction there. They're sick of the corruption that they see all about them. They're sick of this sense of the fact that the rule of law counts for nothing. And what's more, I have spent my time, while I've been working on Russia, which dates back to, makes me feel very old, when there was still a Soviet Union just about, and talking to police officers, which again is not something that Westerners, Western scholars really do. And it's clear that there's been an evolution, and if you look at the current generation of relatively young cops, I'm not saying that they're as absolutely pure and honest as the day is long, but nonetheless, they're clearly a very different type of cop from the sort that you would encounter in the 1990s. These are people who basically they want to do the job, and they are chafing under the fact that their political masters stop them from really going after the criminality. So there is clearly an unsatisfied hunger. Now, because this is not a democracy, it's going to take a long time before it reaches a stage where it sort of pushes forth onto the national agenda. But it is absolutely clear that Russians themselves are not happy with the current criminalized and corrupted status quo.
And in terms of your book, The Vori, Russia's Super Mafia, you trace its history going back to the 18th century, and it got a sort of new lease on life, if you will, during the Stalin's gulag period. Of course, it's worth pointing out that Stalin, Joseph Yugoslavia, was in fact a gangster, a bank robber, an extortionist, a mugger, a thief, before he became the head of the Communist Party of the Soviet Union and the long-serving dictator. Of course, he's been eclipsed in terms of his tenure by Putin. But in the gulags that he set up, there was the traditionalists that goes back to the thieves' society, back to the 18th century, and their code was to never collaborate. And then you had this new group who made a deal with Stalin within the gulag system to run them, and run them on the cheap, in effect, for Stalin, the collaborators, or alias the bitches. And they, of course, completely broke the code of the traditionalists. And so let's start with the showdown after Stalin's death, when the traditionalists and the collaborators went at it in gang wars.
Yeah, I mean, in a way, this had been a long time brewing. Before World War II, as far as the traditionalists were concerned, the collaborators had gone beyond the pale and frankly deserved nothing but a knife in the dark. But on the other hand, they knew that the state would crack down if they didn't think about it. So in some ways, what we almost had was a kind of cold war between these two subcultures. The collaborators didn't try and force the traditionalists to work, and then the traditionalists ignored them. However, when World War II happened, you had a lot of criminals who chose or were forced to go and fight in the Red Army to defend the motherland. They didn't think of themselves as breaking the code of the criminal world. But according to the real purists, just by picking up a rifle and fighting for the state, they had. And so what happened is, after World War II, you actually had a huge influx of people being added to the collaborators' ranks. And in some ways, therefore, the critical mass was too great. They could no longer ignore each other. And so, yes, you had this explosion of violence through the gulag system. You know, a war that was fought through individual killings and sometimes great sort of, you know, mob attacks, in dozens or even hundreds of people sort of breaking into rival parts of the prison camp and murdering everyone they could find. And basically, it made the gulag system ungovernable. I mean, after Stalin's death, his successors basically ran the gulag system down. They opened up most of the camps. And it would be nice to think that in part that was because of some small vestiges of humanitarianism. But in fact, it was because the gulags no longer made economic sense as slave labor camps. And one of the key reasons for that was precisely this war that had broken out within the underworld. And it's a war that ultimately the collaborators won, in part because of their numbers, in part because of their organization, but also in part because the state wanted them to win rather than the people who wouldn't deal with them. And so they made sure that the collaborators were able to sort of cluster in camps in suitable numbers, but also they gave them all kinds of advantages, like, for example, putting them into jobs like cook or barber, which meant that they had access to nice, sharp, shiny metal things, which helped them sort of win their war. So basically, once the gulag system opened up, you had the prisoners being let free. Above all, it was the criminals. And this new breed of collaborator criminal was the one that came out and basically colonized the Soviet underworld after Stalin's death.
And again, I'm speaking with Mark Galeotti, who is a senior researcher at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, an expert on transnational crime and Russian security affairs. He's also advised the British Foreign Office and many governments and law enforcement agencies in Europe and North America. And his latest book just out is The Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. So just to go forward then a little, I want to just go over the history which you document in the book, Mark, before we sort of get into the more contemporary issues, which obviously are very much on people's minds in this country, given the investigation into ties between President Trump and Vladimir Putin. So you go through the communist period, you have this sort of thief society, the Vori, operating. The traditionalists have lost the gang wars. The collaborators are there in the shadows. My understanding is that through the period of stagnation under Brezhnev, that the unofficial economy was the only way that the place was operating. I mean, in effect, the KGB found Gorbachev and promoted him and promoted this idea of glasnost and perestroika, because the KGB were the only people who kept the records and they knew the whole place was falling apart. So they needed this unofficial economy to augment the stagnating, ludicrous, unworkable communist economy. So didn't a relationship therefore exist, since capitalism or private enterprise of any sort was illegal? Didn't the KGB start to regulate the Chechen mafia and the others that were supplying vegetables and stuff like that to the markets? Is that how a relationship began?
Yeah, it's one of these fascinating things that we think of the Soviet Union, that we think of the planned economy and so forth. But in fact, the only thing that, as you say, kept the planned economy working was the fact that the Russians and the Georgians and all the other populations of this country were in fact bread-in-the-bone capitalists, but all in the underground economy behind the scenes, doing deals with friends, with acquaintances and such like. And organized crime played a key role in there, very much as the sort of connective tissue between corrupt party bosses who had the power and the underground economy entrepreneurs who could basically, you know, get the goods, whether it's imported or from within the country that people needed. But meanwhile, the KGB, that was on the one level meant to be fighting corruption, but on the other hand knew that if you took out corruption, the Soviet system would grind to a halt, was also intimately involved in this world. And a lot of gangsters were also informants for the KGB and so forth. So by the time the system actually grinds to a halt and collapses in 1991, you've already got all these kind of connections, which organized crime is already, you know, in bed with budding capitalists, in bed with corrupt officials, in bed with the security police.
So when the system collapses, then you have all of this looting of state enterprises. Now, was that an extension of the old joke in the Soviet Union that we pretend to work and they pretend to pay us? In other words, people were stealing from the state and pilfering stuff all along, were they not?
Yeah, and this is it. And all of a sudden, not only do the old rules and understandings disappear, but also the control apparatuses that were there to try and sort of stop people from stealing disappeared. And you had a government that was ideologically committed to privatizing everything it possibly could because it feared that the communists would come back. And so you had this extraordinary orgy of looting the state and the resources of the country in the 1990s. It was a horrible time for 99.9 recurring percent of Russians. But then there was that small, small fraction who were getting obscenely, extraordinarily rich. I mean, this is a time in which Mercedes-Benz was selling more bulletproof limousines in Russia than in the rest of the world put together. And meanwhile, your average Russian is trying to sort of survive on equivalent of a few dollars a month income. When you have this ideology that basically says, look, everything is about what you can buy, what you can sell, what you can steal, and what you can exploit, we shouldn't be surprised that when the rules totally change and no new rules are in place, people stole as effectively as they could. And everyone who had connections, who had cash, or who had muscle was able to turn that into a lot of money. And that included, obviously, the gangsters.
So then you had, of course, the period of the gang wars in the 90s. I mean, one of the oligarchs that's shown up in the Mueller inquiry, of course, is Deripaska, who's lent a lot of money to Paul Manafort and leaned on him because Manafort stole about 20 to 30 million. And then, of course, the minute that Manafort became Trump's campaign manager, all was forgiven, and Manafort offered Deripaska private briefings. They altered the Republican platform at the convention to be more Russia-friendly. And then the minute that Manafort got fired by Trump, Deripaska came looking for his missing 20 or 30 million. And I think there's a subtext here that Mueller's leaning on. You know, we know they're trying to sweat Manafort into flipping, turning state's evidence. And I think that Manafort's choice of going to jail, which would mean you'd die in an American prison, or getting witness protection from Deripaska might be an issue. But Deripaska, just an example of one of these oligarchs, he supposedly killed about 43 people himself during those wars. But isn't there a distinction between the oligarchs and the Vori, the traditional gangsters, in as much as these guys sort of outmaneuvered the Vori? They were kind of like the bottom feeders. Is that right?
Yeah, I mean, particularly in the 1990s, the worlds of politics, business, and crime got very, very heavily overlapping. But yeah, I mean, one can look at organized crime, which has anyway moved beyond the kind of the tattooed gangsters that we know from the movies and such like. But still, is recognizably, you know, in the shadows. And the world of the oligarchs, these ridiculously rich people who absolutely all got their money through dubious and questionable dealings through the 1990s, and they are apart. But the point is, what we actually get is, in some ways, an alliance. The gangsters are still quite useful for the corrupt rich. Sometimes there might well be an irritating investigative journalist who needs to be silenced, or someone who can launder your money effectively or whatever. So these are a separate worlds, but they absolutely operate in symbiosis with each other.
And where do the Siloviki fit into this picture? The intelligence people that Putin has brought into his inner circle, who many of whom have ended up becoming billionaires too, because many of them, like Torshin, who's also coming up on Mueller's radar, German Khan, who's apparently fascinated with the Godfather movies. So are the Siloviki the newcomers in the looting of Russia?
They've always been there. They were there in the 1990s, but obviously they've had a sort of a major boost when one of their own, i.e. Putin, came into power in 2000. And what we've got is, again, what's happened is actually that the world of these the spooks and the ex-spooks has basically split. Some have stayed within the service and, let's be honest, are often making a lot of money through corruption. But they don't so much get into business themselves as just kind of extort from businesses or provide services. But others make the jump. And the classic example, for example, is Igor Sechin, who is one of the closest people to Putin. He heads up Rosneft, the massive Russian gas company, oil company, and who's ex-military intelligence. But nowadays, you know, he's no longer considered a Silovik. He's no longer considered the intelligence community. You know, he's just another oligarch. So if you really want to make money, you jump out of that world. And if you've got Putin's patronage, you can do that.
And that's the role that Putin does. He's the godfather of the godfather, and he regulates the looting of Russia. And if you cross the line and get too political, like Khodorkovsky did, you're into the gulag, right?
Yeah, that's it. I mean, I think that, you know, we've got to realize that I think Putin nowadays, since he came back into power in 2012, I think he's less interested personally in money and looting Russia as he is in his ideological campaign to make Russia great again, to basically write his place in the history books as the Tsar who brought Russia back to where it ought to be. But certainly a key element of his power is precisely he is the guy who hands out the contracts. He is the guy who adjudicates the disputes. As you say, precisely like a godfather, or in some ways almost a King Lear, you know, waiting for his daughters to come and tell him how much they love him, and he'll apportion out the kingdom depending on how well they do. It's his capacity to basically play off the elite against each other, which is absolutely central to his unquestioned power in this state.
So just to move to the current situation with the investigation into Donald Trump, apparently he's more concerned about the FBI raid on his lawyer Michael Cohen's office, hotel room, and a home. At least he's equally concerned. Michael Cohen, of course, is very much a tolkoch, the pusher, the Russian word for fixer. And he's Trump's fixer. I mean, he says that himself. But it turns out, of course, he's got longstanding ties through his Ukrainian wife to organized crime. His father-in-law actually runs a catering hall, as they call it, a mob catering hall in Brighton Beach for where all the Russian gangsters hang out. And, of course, Trump has had Russian gangsters buying into condos into Trump Tower and everywhere else in all of his other properties, including the one down in Panama, which is entirely bought up by Russian, Italian, and Colombian gangsters and drug dealers. So what's your sense of the confluence there between Russian organized crime and American organized crime through characters like Trump's tolkoch, Michael Cohen?
Well, look, the way that the Russians have internationalized, and it's worth mentioning, I mean, the Russian organized crime is the most global of all the different sort of criminal phenomena. But the way they've done this is not by trying to, like, take over territory or anything like that. They tried that a bit in the 1990s, and it didn't work. So instead, what they have come out as basically being the criminal service providers. They don't try and take over markets. They don't try and fight wars with local gangsters. They turn to the local gangsters, whether it's in America or Europe or beyond, and say, what do you need? Because we can probably provide it for you. Do you need money laundering services? Well, basically, the Russian banking system is a black hole. Once your money goes through there, no one's going to track it. Do you need drugs? Well, a third of Afghan heroin comes through Russia, and we swap heroin with the Colombians for cocaine, so we can do that too. Do you want women? Do you want contract killers? Do you want hackers? Whatever. So this is it. They are basically the one-stop shop for the world's gangsters. And so they are deal makers beyond anything else. And we see this in the United States. There's not that much of what we would think of as kind of Russian or post-Soviet organized crime outside the worlds of Medicare and Medicaid fraud and a whole variety of other frauds. They're very good at frauds. They're used to working systems. But otherwise, what happens is, in some ways, they are the service providers to the gangs we see on the streets. They can give them all kind of assets. But, of course, what this means is they have a lot of money sloshing around that they need to do something with. And I think this is where we see the connection, in my opinion, with the Trump organization. I have yet to see signs, certainly from the Russian side, of a kind of clear, conscious, personal connection with Trump. You know, we're not seeing gangsters coming up to Trump and saying, we want you to launder our money, we want you to work with you. On the other hand, the Trump organization is so badly run that in some ways it's a pyramid scheme. It constantly, desperately needs more money coming in to make up for that fact. And it's clearly got an operating ethos, which is basically that business is business and we don't care where the money comes from. So if you are basically a dodgy character with dodgy money, it doesn't really matter if you're a Russian gangster or a Saudi kleptocrat or a Nigerian oil runner or whatever. You can probably basically, you know, do business with the Trump organization. It's a great way of getting your money into the States and, in effect, laundering it. So the story I see is essentially that this is a symptom, that the Russian gang connection is as much as anything else a symptom of a certain kind of moral corruption, again, just my personal perspective. And obviously, Russian organized crime took fullest advantage of that. If you've got someone who's basically opening the doors to you, of course you're going to walk through those doors. But it's not just Russians. I think that's something we need to be very clear about.
Well, I thank you so much, Mark. I must say your book is so rich and descriptive. It's extraordinary. And I appreciate you joining us here today.
My very great pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Mark Galeotti, who's a senior researcher at the Institute of International Relations in Prague, an expert on transnational crime and Russian security affairs. He has also advised the British Foreign Office and many government and law enforcement agencies in Europe and North America. And his latest book just out is The Vori, Russia's Super Mafia. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an analysis of the political upheaval in Italy, which has spooked the markets. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images. Welcome to Background Briefing, Ruth Ben-Ghiat.
Thank you.
And Ruth, since you're an Italian scholar, or a scholar of Italy and Italian politics, can you help us figure out what's going on? I mean, there was a recent election. Obviously, it was inconclusive. A coalition government was formed by the left-wing Five Star Movement and the right-wing Northern League, and now the normally politically neutral, if not irrelevant, head of state, Sergio Mattarella, has basically refused to accept a nominee as finance minister, who's a Eurosceptic, and essentially that government has collapsed, or the coalition has collapsed. And now he has asked Carlo Cottarelli, a former IMF official, to form an interim government of technocrats before an election at some point in the future. So anything you want to add to that rather sketchy summary?
Sure, that all of this plays right into the hands of Matteo Salvini, who is the leader of the Italian League Party, which paired up with Five Star for the elections, but got only 17% versus Five Star 32%. And he is a very savvy politician, and many speculate that he proposed an unacceptable finance minister, Paolo Savona, the Eurosceptic, in order to make the government fail and also have this kind of newbie that no one knew, so a weak rather than strong prime ministerial candidate, Giuseppe Conte. And in fact, it seems strange to many that the entire government could fall just due to one appointment being refused and no alternative was proposed. So Salvini is widely seen as wanting to have new elections. He's a candidate of chaos. He's advised by Stephen Bannon. This is the most important thing to remember. Bannon went to Rome for the last elections, and they're in very close contact. So he is this chaos populist candidate. And Mattarella, the president, seemed tone deaf by appointing an IMF veteran, because this plays perfectly into the populist grievance about out-of-touch elites and globalization. So if there is a next election, many are speculating that Salvini will do very well.
And Salvini's party, the Northern League, how would you describe them? I mean, they're loosely described as a right-wing party, but right-wing in Italy can be kind of scary, right?
Yes, they're very much a right-wing party. And indeed, they used to be called the Northern League. And originally in the 90s, when they were in a coalition with Berlusconi and neo-fascists, their enemy was kind of the Southerner. Now they're just anti-immigration, so they're trying to be a national party, unite Northern and Southerners around anti-immigration. And Salvini is a very dangerous individual. During the last election campaign, he actually talked openly on video and in print about doing ethnic cleansing. And he said, we need a cleansing, you know, neighborhood by neighborhood, street by street. And what he said the other day, which has people worried, is he said, you know, if this doesn't work, we will go to Rome. And no one in Italy can fail to understand that this is a reference to Mussolini's March on Rome. So he is actively fanning the flames of right-wing extremism. And so this is very worrying.
But how could he, I mean, Hitler came into power with one-third of the vote, and that was enough for him to grab power. But the figures that you gave earlier, Ruth, what was it, about 17% as opposed to 45% in the coalition? What were the figures?
Well, he got 17%, Five Star got 32%, and to have a reference point, the left, which seems completely paralyzed, which is part of the problem, got 19%. But you know, things can change very fast, and Luigi Di Maio, who is the very young, inexperienced head of Five Star, has not had a very good showing. And the league, he can't compete with Salvini. And in fact, and Beppe Grillo has been flip-flopping constantly about the euro. And then Di Maio, he's again 31 years old, practically no political experience. He asked for the president, Mattarella, to be impeached the other day, which didn't go over well. So most observers feel that if next time elections come, it will be reversed, and it will be the League and the very flashy Salvini, who's married to a model, who gets glamorized, he has an earring, as though that matters. you can be an ethnic cleanser and have an earring, and that doesn't make you very glamorous. Violence is never glamorous. But there's a trajectory at foot that one can imagine that it will be reversed, and the league will get the 30% or more, and five-star will decline slightly.
And again, I'm speaking with Ruth Ben-Ghiat, who is a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been the recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images. Now, for some reason or other, George Soros is continually demonized, not the least of which by Roseanne Barr. But George Soros is trying to fund now a redo of Brexit. And it would seem that everybody, or at least a majority in England, recognize that that was a terrible mistake. Why these bottom feeders like Bannon and Farage were able to pull that off is pretty extraordinary. And of course, Putin was in the shadows as well. Is there any chance of that happening and reversing this trend? Because I take it that what's happening in Italy is also playing into Putin's playbook.
Yes, and it's, you know, very worrying because Italy does have the third largest economy in the Eurozone, and you have, you know, again, the leaders of the two largest parties, Beppe Grillo and Salvini, you know, intermittently saying that they'd like to get out of the euro. But somebody made a very funny video that, you know, showed both these party leaders flip-flopping every day about, you know, we should be in the euro, we should be out of the euro. And most people don't think that Italy is really going to get out of the euro. The markets are very unsettled and nervous today because of the just the prospect of it, which is why I think Mattarella wanted to appoint a technocrat who has decades of financial experience. That's what Carlo Cottarelli is known for. And for cutting debt, he's called Mr. Scissors. It's his nickname for, you know, his penchant for trying to cut through debt. So there's a reason Mattarella made this decision, and it could be a wise economic decision, but politically it's seen as playing into the hands of Salvini.
So is there a chance, though, of the Democratic Party coming back, the center-left? God knows socialists around Europe are just... It's some kind of sclerosis that has happened where they're just all dying off. What's the chances of a revival, at least, and if not on the left, on the center-left?
Well, you know, sclerosis is an interesting word because the one thing that the Democratic Party had in Italy was youth. You know, Matteo Renzi is a young guy. He's a dynamic guy, and he was, you know, riding very high, and then he fell into disgrace. And they haven't been able, and this is a common thing in Europe and a little bit in our Democratic Party, they haven't been able to find a winning message or a winning messenger. And I think that, you know, my feeling is you have to fight fire with fire. You have to find somebody who's a real firebrand, charismatic, in order to have any chance of competing with these other parties. But they seem unable to come up with a package. And during the election, both the League and Five Star had this very appealing idea to people of a kind of basic income, a universal income. And even though it was very clear to experts that there was no way to fund this, it got them a lot of votes. So, you know, the Democrats are not used to making these kind of very unrealistic proposal, very blithely. And, the rules of politics have changed, and the Democratic Party it doesn't want to, perhaps, or can't change with them.
Well, but Macron came out of nowhere in France and formed a center-right party from the, you know, with a sclerotic socialist party and a discredited conservative party. So such things can happen. I take it you don't think it's necessarily going to happen in Italy, but...
Well, Macron, the thing is, Macron came from the sector of business, mm-hmm. and he wasn't a career politician. And I think the problem is that the party structures, and we're seeing this again in the United States with the Democrats, although it's a much better situation. We'll actually have a lot of winning candidates in America. But the Democratic Party, again, sclerotic is a good word because they have a certain ways of doing things that are party politics. And Macron was able to triumph because he wasn't weighed down by those traditions. And so perhaps if the Democratic Party can find somebody like that who's not a career politician, it could work. But so far, I haven't seen any possible candidates like that.
Well, just in the last couple of minutes, though, is it possible, though, that the Italian public could be educated to the reality that an exit from the Europe would certainly lead to a sovereign debt crisis, and that, frankly, at the end of the day, Italians have to decide whether they care about their bank accounts more than being angry at Brussels?
It would be nice if they could be educated to that. Often in politics, that it's not about reason and logic. It's about rhetoric and seeming passion and or even irrational things such as hatred of those who don't look like you, which are selling very well right now. And so, you know, what I'm worried about is that that will prevail in Italy as it's prevailed other places. And today, Matteo Salvini talked about, he's calling a rally to support the idea that the president of Italy should be elected directly by the people, which is, again, another dangerous idea, and, you know, the whole idea of the referendum, referenda, which is very popular with populists. But, you know, there's a reason that Germany doesn't have referenda, because they are, again, they are a dangerous political tool in the hands of demagogues. So I just fear that whatever the realities of economic proposals that, for example, the Democratic Party might make during elections, that's not where people are right now.
So just in closing, surely have the Italians noticed what's happened to America under Trump, where populist right-wing leaders can take us on a road to hell?
I think some of them are in a lot of them support populism right now. And whatever they may think of Trump, they are in this kind of nativist moment themselves. And also remember that a lot of them are getting, a certain kind of fake news, Trump-generated, Fox-generated equivalents of fake news. And so it's very hard to know what they're taking away in reality about Trump.
Well, Ruth Ben-Gad, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you, Ian.
And again, I've been speaking with Ruth Ben-Gad, who's a professor of history and Italian studies at New York University and a cultural critic who has been a recipient of Guggenheim, Fulbright, and other fellowships. She writes and speaks frequently on fascism, war, racism, authoritarian rulers, propaganda, and the politics of images. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon and assistant producer Alejandra Lariva-Lutt. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can also contact me, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.